Hi everyone, and welcome to the inaugural episode of Commerce Confidential, the APAC edition, a brand new podcast series brought to you by VML. VML is a global brand, customer experience, and commerce agency that's a part of the WPP network. I'm Adit Bimbat, a director of commerce at VML, and your host for the show. Join us as we uncover strategies, tools, and trends that are shaping the way brands and consumers engage in commerce today. In this first episode, we're going to dive deep into our latest intelligence report called Tomorrow Commerce, which examines 20 key trends that we believe can shape the future of commerce. By the way, if you want to access this report, you can download a copy for free from our website, which is simply vml.com. We'll also add a link to the report in the description. And to help me unpack all the goodness in the report, I'm joined by our Global Marketing Director of Enterprise Solutions, Hugh Fletcher, and our Head of Innovation for VML Enterprise Solution, Naji El Arifi, who have helped co-author the report. Welcome, guys, and thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Well, before we dive into the meaty stuff, let's start with some quick introductions. Can you tell us a little bit about your backgrounds and your history at VML? Hugh, if we could start with you.
Yeah, so I've now been with VML for 8 years, or, you know, what was previously Salmon, Wunderman Thompson Commerce. So been with the company for quite some time. And actually before that was client side. So worked for about 11 and a half years in automotive and actually recruited what was then Salmon to help me out when I was at Audi trying to establish e-com in automotive. So that's how I first came across what was originally Salmon, what is now VML Enterprise Solutions. And 8 years later, here I am.
Awesome.
And mine not that different, apart from I wasn't client side, but I was about 7 years ago. Worked at another agency leading products and innovation, and then got a phone call from Hugh, who used to be my client a couple of years before that, and asked me to join what was Salmon to help out doing some innovation, looking at new tech. And now basically that's what I do, look at new tech, see how we can apply it, help out with the research that we do. Yeah, kind of fun.
Awesome. So we've got the dynamic duo on the show then. That's great.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Well, cool. Let's just jump right into it. And the Tomorrow Commerce Report. I know this is the seventh edition, which is quite amazing. And I know that you guys have been working on all the past editions, or most of them. Can you tell us why this report has proven so popular and how it's evolved over time?
Yeah, so actually, I mean, yeah, it does feel like a very long time ago that we first started this. But actually, we have to kind of give credit to our brilliant colleagues over in VML Intelligence with their Future 100 report, because this is where this came out of. So we read a Future 100 report a good few years ago, and we said, oh, this is brilliant. It's so insightful. It's exactly what people want to read. But is there a commerce version? You know, where is it that we can kind of delve into what's happening, particularly in commerce and e-com? And sort of some of the new emerging channels. And the answer was there wasn't really anything like that. So at the time, I sort of mentioned this to someone and they said, well, if you want to do it, go ahead and do it. And that's how it started. So we get a whole load of people from across the organization into a room. We talk about the trends that we've seen in the market over the last 12 months. We talk about where commerce is going. We get some insights from our clients as well. So what are they asking us? What are they thinking about? What are some of the things they're seeing? And then we sort of talk about, think about all these different trends and whittle it down to about 20 top trends that we see impacting the market in the next 5, 10, 15 years. And I guess the important thing to say about Tomorrow's Commerce versus some of the other research that we do is that this really focuses on a long-term view of what might happen. We will probably reference a lot of our research throughout this podcast, some of the research which we do, which is about the here and now, some of the research which you do about some particular trends, but this, I suppose, is much more far reaching and looking further into the future.
It's also a chance for us to kind of be a bit more creative and kind of think really far. And like some of them are crazy. And that's the whole point. It's a chance for us to really think and stretch our minds as to what could potentially happen in the future when it comes to commerce.
And actually, some trends we think are very silly, don't we, Naji? Which then subsequently sort of come into being, and we think, oh, we were really sort of being creative with that idea. I didn't think that was going to happen, and here we are. So
Yeah, I have to say that when I read the report, some of the trends I hadn't even stopped to think about. So when you say that there was an element of creativity or some visioning into the future, I can definitely see that.
I think that's a really good point, Alec, because that's why we do these things, is that I think our clients are often kind of head down. They're thinking about their quarterly, half year, yes, year targets. They just don't have an opportunity to think about where the market's going. And I suppose what we do, talking sort of semi-seriously about it, is we take that responsibility for them. We think about where the market might be going and give them some ideas about some of the strategic elements they need to be planning for.
Yeah, I think that's great, especially in APAC. I don't know if you see this in EMEA as well, but in APAC, there's a focus on the short term. You know, everyone's sort of focused in, laser focused on 12 months. But to have a point of view about what the future holds globally, I think is super interesting. And then with regards to the trends, I mean, could you maybe talk about how you went about gathering the data that powers the insights? Because I think that you spend a lot of time speaking to a lot of people from across different backgrounds, and I'd love to just understand that process with you as well.
Yeah, I mean, for this one in particular, what we tend to do is we tend to gather data from our other pieces of research. So our big piece of research, which we do each year, is called Future Shopper. That covers 18 countries, 31,000 consumers. So we get a lot of our data from that. We do a variety of different research. So we've just done one called Trailblazers of Tomorrow, looking into Generation Alpha and social commerce. So we pull data from that. But really, as Naji said, this is more about being creative and thinking longer term. So while we use those inputs to sometimes inform some of these trends, really this is about where do we think the market's going to be going. And in our organization, we have some absolutely brilliant people working across so many different countries, so many different clients, doing so many different things, that actually when we ask them, where do we think the market's going, what do you think is going to happen in 10 years time, we get some absolutely brilliant pieces of feedback, and that forms the basis of this report.
Very nice. And for the reports that you've mentioned, I'll put a link into the description as well, so people can check those out if listeners are interested. But yeah, let's jump into some of the trends, shall we? The first one really piqued my interest. The first one is called a new brand order with less brand equity. And I found this interesting because I think you covered a variation of it in the 2023 edition of the report, where you talked about the rising influence of influencers and the power of disruptive brands that are built by these influencers. So would you say that the nature of brand building has changed fundamentally, especially when we think about younger Gen Z audiences?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's exactly what we find. And I think the way we kind of came at this was, you know, there are so many big historic brands. There's always been a lot of talk about brand equity, building that brand equity, barriers to entry for new brands. And what we see really is that's changed, or is changing. We see new disruptive brands coming along. We see them coming to market quicker. We see them creating their brand equity quicker. We see them reaching scale much quicker. And I think, you know, a great example of that, as we pulled out in the report, obviously is Prime Hydration. And I have an 11-year-old son, and this was just a massive thing in his life and in his friend's life. And getting hold of a bottle of Prime was like, you know, finding gold. We'd have to stop at different shops when we were driving around to see if they had Prime in it. If there was one there, we had to buy a bottle of Prime. So what was interesting to sort of look at was how quickly this brand became so important to this younger demographic. And actually, we did some research back in 2019 into Generation Alpha. So for anyone who doesn't know what Generation Alpha is, we roughly kind of say that's 6 to 16-year-olds. So the generation that comes after Gen Z, and we did some research into this generation, and there was a really weird stat which came out, which is that 14% of Generation Alpha wanted to buy directly from influencers, and we thought, this is a bit of an odd stat. So it wasn't even buying something that was endorsed by an influencer; it was bought directly from an influencer. And then over the course of the next, I guess, 5 years since that research was done, we've seen that actually come to life. We see influencers and celebrities sort of harnessing the massive media power and the massive follower numbers that they have, and then thinking, actually, I can kind of become a retailer in my own right. I can become a seller in my own right. I can become a brand in my own right, and launching it through these new media channels to a much younger audience. And I think what's interesting for us then is to say, okay, well, what does that mean for legacy brands? What does that mean for these historical brands? And how can we help some of our clients prepare for what might be coming? How can we help them engage with influencers? How can we help them think about what some of those disruptor brands might be like? So
yeah,
for us, a really interesting area to look into.
Awesome. And when you say new media channels, I'm guessing you mean TikTok as being one of the major ones up there. Especially if Gen Alpha starts at 6 years old, I imagine some of the younger audiences are coming from TikTok.
TikTok, gaming. Gaming's a big one as well, so can't forget about Twitch, can't forget about Kick, YouTube gaming, and things like that. So this encapsulates some of these newer media formats that are seen a little bit more social now, specifically gaming as well.
And could I recommend, if anyone really wants to know about new media channels, is have a child, because it really forces you to have a look at where people are going for their information. And they challenge you and they say, why are you doing that? And they say, I want to download this app and I want to spend my time looking at this media channel. It's a really good way to understand all these new media channels.
Yeah, and I think that the this is going to hurt present and future parents' wallets, but the compression between brand love and brand buy is also what's enabling this sort of generation that's hungry to get what they want. And they're not willing to compromise, I believe, on some of on the things that they see as valuable to them. Which brings me to the trend that I read on the power of social conversion, which talks about the power of social commerce, similar to what she was saying with influencers. What I would say about social coming from an APAC perspective is we see a lot of, because you have a more singular ecosystem in China, we see a big liftoff or takeoff in social and social commerce coming out of China. And the rest of the region is sort of catching up to it, but you know, that's sort of like the linchpin of the region. But could you maybe talk about this trend in the context of what you've uncovered as far as what social conversion is?
Yeah, sure. I mean, a lot. One of the main stats that we got from I think it was Future Shopper last year, was around something we call compressed commerce.
Yeah.
And this is the idea of getting from inspiration all the way through to purchase as quickly as possible. And one of the downfalls right now, social in the West, is that you don't really have a lot of ability to, say, purchase directly through social.
Mm.
However, in China, it's really well formulated, and it seems to be a path that a lot of people are taking to make purchases. And so when we were thinking about that, we thought, well, as and when that starts to become better implemented, we're more than likely going to see this huge explosion into the usage of social. So it just makes sense that social is going to end up being one of the most, let's say, used or quickest ways to get from inspiration all the way through to purchase. But like I said, at the minute, you're looking at Instagram, we're looking at Facebook and just going, well, you know, the back-end systems aren't really integrated yet. So you haven't got access to livestock, you know, customer support. It's not really well formulated. How do you return things? You know, I bought something on Instagram. Yeah. How do I return that? What's that process going to be like? So there's a load of questions that consumers have around that. But there seems to be a lot we're learning from China and from APAC that we're more than likely going to end up bringing to the West. So I think we're kind of looking over to China and just going, actually, this seems like it makes complete sense. You know, I'm swiping through Instagram. I should be able to get inspired and just purchase. And if young people are spending a lot of time in social, the dots just seem to line up really well.
Yeah. And I think the ecosystem fragmentation is quite apparent for us, even in Southeast Asia, outside of China, where, you know, on a funny note, like when we want to buy something from a so-called influencer, you typically go to one of the local marketplaces, or maybe it's even TikTok. And I've been a victim of this, where we've ordered something and we actually get an empty box delivered to us. And so it is a very emerging space for consumers in this market, where they're willing to pay cheap prices for products, but the entire experience is still a work in progress. And I wager that
with Amazon sort of having its Amazon Live or Walmart having Walmart Creator, they might think through these elements of the experience with a lot more detail.
Yeah, exactly. And they'll have more access to more products. There's a much better review process.
Yeah.
It's a trusted brand. So if you're buying it through it, you think you're going to, right, if it's Amazon, it should arrive tomorrow or it should arrive in, you know, 2 days or whatever it might be. So yeah, as soon as these guys get all right, I think it's just going to, it's going to pop off.
But I read a great article a little while ago about sort of the cultural differences and why APAC's been much more embracing of things like social commerce and kind of influencer commerce and things like that. And the reason being that actually in the West, we tend to have very historic loyalty to many retailers, which is slightly harder to break. Whereas in APAC, consumers are much more happy to jump ship and try something new. So it'll be interesting to see how it kind of develops in the West. And obviously there've been a number of different attempts to do things like live stream commerce in the West, which just haven't quite succeeded. So we feel like there's a massive opportunity coming. Mm. We feel like it's going to happen, but at the moment consumers aren't quite ready for it.
And I think the point you made, Hugh, on loyalty is quite interesting, because some of the stats coming out of APAC for us are that consumers are now choosing to shop from more websites. In fact, the numbers doubled. So if on average they shopped 4 websites before, they're now shopping almost 8 websites. And so that breadth is sort of expanding, that maturity is increasing, but loyalty is on the fall as a result. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how that evolves in region. But the points you made about, you know, the way in which an Amazon would approach this versus what another player in APAC would have to do to catch up is quite interesting. And speaking of platforms like Amazon, I know that retail media is also on the rise globally, and that one of the trends that you guys had covered in the report talks about the rise of retail media, which seems to be quite consistent globally. Could you maybe talk a bit more about the findings that you have in that trend? I saw some great stats coming out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we find is that this is an area which businesses are really interested in. Obviously, it has multiple benefits. So it has a benefit as a revenue stream. It has a benefit as a method of attracting consumers to sites, and really monetizing and understanding the role of a variety of different sites is key to growth. So, So lots of the conversations we're having with clients is what can they do with their own sites? So how can they monetize their own sites and sell media space? How can they attract more consumers to their sites by using media on other channels? And again, going back to your point before about sort of getting consumers at the right time, these are consumers who are in the process of searching or getting inspiration, and sometimes in the process of purchasing. And if you can get to them at the right time, then what this means is that you have a ready-made consumer who's ready to purchase, arriving at your site at the right time, and then purchasing very quickly. And that's obviously sort of the holy grail of what we want when consumers come to our sites. And we've done a lot of work into this, into how you don't want attrition from your site. So you don't want consumers coming to your site just for inspiration or just for search. You actually then want to make them transact. So the stages at which you get them to your sites, the stages at which you acquire them, are very important in making sure that they then purchase and convert on your site.
And it sort of creates that closed loop that's very appealing to advertisers and brands as well. So they see that ROI coming through with a lot more of a return as well.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Connected to that trend, you did cover a topic that I found very interesting called creative commerce. And one of the things we're noticing as far as awards are concerned is that there is an entire new category for creative commerce coming out of all the top award competitions globally. Could you maybe elaborate on what you found to be the value add of creative commerce and why brands should pay attention?
Well, we sort of have a bit of a wry smile here, because actually lots of what me and Naji do is go into clients and talk to them about commerce and what was originally e-commerce.
Yeah.
And part of our role was to try and make commerce seem exciting? That was one of the sort of the briefs that we got. How do we bring to life the interest and the excitement of commerce? Because I guess sometimes the complexity, the fact that it's systems based, the amount of data maybe turns people off. We have always found commerce exciting and creative. We've always thought it's interesting because it is a huge revenue stream.
Yeah.
But what we increasingly see with clients is to talk about how do you engage consumers? We've talked about the number of different channels that they go through. We've talked about the fact that they're searching more, they're going to numerous sites. So standout is required. You need to be doing something that is interesting, that is engaging. And that covers some very basic elements. So we talk a lot about, you know, the price being right, the availability right, the service elements right. Yes, but what we also want to deliver is a really interesting, creative, engaging experience. And again, there are some stats in Future Shopper which sort of say quite a few consumers find the online shopping experience quite boring. So while it is fantastic in terms of an endless aisle, while it's fantastic in terms of being able to search for pretty much anything you want and being able to transact easily, perhaps it lacks a bit of engagement and excitement. And again, we talk to lots of luxury clients as well. How do you create that kind of differentiated luxury experience? And that can be quite difficult. So I think creative commerce for us is, you know, really understanding when consumers are buying, what they're buying, what's happening in culture, how can we engage them? How can we attract them when they get to the commerce experience, no matter where that is? Is it engaging? Does it move them through the experience quickly? And ultimately, the better experience that consumers have, the more likely they are to convert with you. And obviously, that is the end goal.
And I think one thing to add to that is, like, if you are a, let's say you're a brand and everyone's now starting to get the fundamentals right.
Yeah.
If everyone's getting the fundamentals right, what is your differentiation to everyone else? Or is this now a commodity market where it's just about price?
Yes.
If everything is the same, how do you differentiate? And part of that is how you get creative with the experience. How do you get creative with service? How do you get creative with your marketing? These are the things that will end up differentiating. If, you know, if everyone's website just looked the same and, you know, everyone delivered next day, well, now what are you, what is the difference between everyone? Is it just a pair of shoes or is it more than that? So that's where creativity can really start to excel a brand and take it to the next level. Because at some point, we're all going to get the fundamentals right.
Yeah.
So it's about where do you go from there?
And I think you had a great stat coming out of this trend in the report that said that creativity is the second biggest driver of marketing effectiveness behind brand size, which I found to be super interesting. And it also said that it delivers an ROI that's 12x, you know, any other variable. And I think that's super interesting for us as an agency that, you know, works in a creative space and combines that with technology, but also for brands who are sometimes a bit too laser focused on sales and they forget about the entire piece around brand equity through the use of creativity. So I thought that was a very interesting takeaway as well.
And referring back to the trend around sort of new disruptor brands coming in,
yeah.
I mean, this is where these historic brands need to think about how they are engaging with their consumers. It's not good enough just to keep on doing what you're doing before. It's not good enough to rely on historic brand equity. I think the only thing we would always say around creativity is it has to be built on a foundation of fantastic service. You have to get the fundamentals right. And that then allows you the license to go and be creative. A brand just being creative, which is not delivering great service, availability, you know, quick and easy delivery, quick and easy returns, then perhaps it isn't a differentiator. But if you have the basis right, if you then layer on the creativity, then you're cooking on gas.
Yeah. I mean, there's no point being the most creative company in the world if your buy button doesn't work.
True that. Right. And I'm sure that's more common than we'd like it to be as well.
Yeah.
It's something everyone should wake up and just double check. Make sure checkout works if you have a website.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is something we see quite often when we have those quarter four peaks. So obviously in APAC and in China, things like Singles Day, for us, Black Friday, you know, yes, you can have a great campaign. Yes, you can drive consumers to your site, but the experience has to be great when you get there. And I think actually what we've seen over the last couple of years is most businesses actually getting that right, prepping properly, being able to manage the load that comes to their sites, being able to ensure the availability of products is there. But historically, we did see this where fantastic creative campaigns were driving to consumers to sites, which then were falling over. Thankfully, and hopefully, a thing of the past.
Yeah, we have I remember seeing a case study within VML that talked about Oreo codes. Have you guys seen that one?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a fantastic one in the creative commerce space. And you know, for those listening, you could check that out on our website as well. A great example of a brand using creativity and technology in very innovative ways, which I found, and the results sort of speak to themselves. They had a great impact on sales at the very end. So it is possible to combine both those practices together.
Absolutely.
And you made an interesting point about the shift from product-only brands to service-led brands as differentiators of the branded experience. But that also then leads me to a few different trends in the report that talk about purpose and sustainability. And I think there were two or three trends that sort of spoke to this. But in generally, like, what were you uncovering in the report from a sustainability standpoint that brands should pay attention to? I'd love to dive into that as well.
Yeah, well, I think what we like to do is we like to test some of those theories that are out in the market. So lots of talk about sustainability, lots of talk about purpose. Nagy and I are sometimes a little bit cynical about everything, not just this, about everything. Yeah. And we like to say...
Not cynical. We like to test things. So we want to prove things. We want to prove things.
Sorry, yeah. So where these sort of themes are driving strategic decisions, what we like to ask ourselves is that the right thing to happen? What are consumers saying and what are consumers doing? And we've, for a number of years, particularly through our Future Shop report, we've looked at things like sustainability. Now, the message for sustainability is super clear. It is very important. More and more people understanding their impact on the environment, more and more people wanting businesses to operate in a much more sustainable way. And when we ask consumers, is this important? The answer is a resounding yes. Do they want businesses that have sustainable practices? Yes. Do they want more sustainable packaging? Yes. But we sometimes are a little bit cynical because what we also hear is data about consumers wanting things faster and cheaper and being able to return them. And so when we then ask consumers about changes to their commerce experience or changes to online shopping, we tend to find the elements around pricing and delivery and returns come almost higher than sustainability.
Yeah.
Now, the good news, I think, is that is the trend is upwards in terms of consumers who are actively choosing sustainable options. And we tried to track things like Amazon Day Delivery, for instance. So, you know, choosing to have a number of your orders packaged together and sent at a slightly slower delivery speed to make sure that you look after the environment. That we see an increase in that. But again, going back to this point that we keep on banging on about, is sustainability is a very important differentiator. It's a very important driving factor in many purchases, but it has to be built on fantastic service. It has to be built on the right price. It has to be built on fast delivery. It has to be built on easy returns. It has to be built on range. And we keep on saying the same boring things, so I apologize. But these are things that have to be built on a really strong foundation. That's the same for things like purpose. So again, especially younger consumers, and this came out very clearly in our Trailblazers report. Purpose, very important in terms of who consumers are buying from. Consumers want to buy from businesses that have a purpose that goes beyond just selling products and services. So these are very important elements and will become more important. I think just a final point on sustainability from me. while we felt that it was going to be the younger generations that were really driving it, actually what we saw was a spread across all different age groups. So sustainability certainly is something that all age groups deem to be very important.
Interesting. Naji, any thoughts?
I mean, it kind of said it all because we talk about it all the time. No one is going to, like, you can do a sustainable delivery option, for example, but if it arrives in 2 weeks, you'll be amazed at how many people will just say no. And a lot of people will talk about, you know, sustainability is important to me. I think about it all the time. But I'm an Amazon Prime subscriber and I get all my deliveries done next day. And it's like, if you really cared, you check the box that says sustainable delivery and get it all delivered on a Friday, right?
Yep.
And so there's just a bit of a disconnect where consumers are expecting brands and companies to pick up the slack because they're not willing to sacrifice the experience. Because at the end of the day, when we're out and about and someone asks us, is the environment important? Everyone says yes. And then as soon as you go behind closed doors, people are like, well, I kind of need these, I don't know, batteries delivered to me next day, even though you know, I'm fine to wait. You know what I mean?
Guilty of that.
There's a great stat, wasn't there? Sorry, there's a great stat, wasn't there? Actually, from Generation Alpha, which was from the US data.
The 24 hours one.
Yeah, 45% of Generation Alpha won't buy from an online retailer that can't deliver in 24 hours.
Interesting.
So really demanding in terms of the delivery. But at the same time, when asked, is sustainability important? The answer is yes, it's very important. So we see these quite conflicting emotions when it comes to commerce. And the problem is that these challenges are being given to brands and to retailers to deal with. So deliver me something fast, but make sure it's sustainable and make sure you have purpose in terms of your business. That is a very hard challenge for many businesses to achieve.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying is that experience remains the gatekeeper for sort of higher level ambitions and needs, such as sustainability. And in fact, I read in the report, it said 52% of consumers claim to have changed their shopping habits because of concerns around the environment. Mm-hmm. But to your point, I think you also mentioned that they actually want brands and retailers to step up their efforts, which is an interesting push and pull, if you will, on this topic of sustainability.
Because again, they may have chosen to change their shopping habit in the sense of maybe they're now choosing a brand that's more environmentally friendly, right? But can deliver them the experience that they want.
Yes.
So it's not so much about them going, we can't find out deep enough as to exactly what they've done.
Yeah.
But it seems to be that more brands are now choosing these sustainability options. I, for example, choose Amazon Day Delivery, which is why my doorbell went a few seconds ago. And my delivery's downstairs on my driveway because I'm getting everything delivered on one particular day. But you know, whether or not more and more people start to try these things, which we've gotten data saying that yes, every year people are testing them out, it's going to be interesting to see how brands cope with it, right? Because they're going up against Amazon, who are being able to deliver these kinds of experiences. You can only really do it huge scale. So if you're like a smaller regional company, do you have the scale to be able to deliver some of these experiences? It's going to be tough.
And it also goes back to the planning, I think, because we, you know, as we said right at the outset, one of the main reasons why we do Tomorrow's Commerce is to encourage businesses to plan a little bit further ahead. So again, we did some research a few years ago, which said across the UK and the US, the average planning cycle for a digital commerce leader was 15.5 months. And yet when you look at some of these huge retailers, when you look at some of the big marketplaces, they are planning almost decades ahead. And if they're going to be, I guess, your facilitators, but in some cases your competitors in the future, then businesses need to think on a bit of a longer term. And particularly when it comes to things like service, that sometimes requires some pretty big investments into infrastructure. And that takes time, you know?
Yeah, and I think the investments, it's interesting because this may be happening globally, but definitely in APAC, as far as investments are concerned, we're actually seeing a demand from our consumer base in APAC where they've been programmed over years of Super Brand Day. If you've heard of these Super Brand Days that we do this side of the world, they've been programmed to accept only lower prices. And so challenge that brands are finding is that while that's great for customer acquisition and while that's great for, you know, balancing the long and the short in terms of sales, it sort of built this behavior and pattern with consumers where they only want the cheapest price, but they also expect the best service and the best utility on their purchase, which is a very difficult dichotomy to navigate if you're a brand that's trying to now, you know, focus on both revenue and profit. So do you have any advice? I know you covered this trend on price being paramount. Do you have any advice for brands around how they might balance this tricky equation?
I mean, it comes back again to this idea of service and service-led brands being important. If you can tell the story of, you know, what are you getting for that money? You know, is there, you know, a longer warranty that comes along with that? Are you paying extra because the delivery is better, because the customer service is better, because the packaging is better? You know, I mean, Apple sells very expensive products, right? You can say, you know, you compare them to a cheaper Android phone and you go, well, there's still a phone, but the experience you get from one compared to the other is a lot different, right? Like you go into the store, you get a much different experience. Yeah. So I think if you can prove and be honest about what you're getting, and what things you've put on top of just an item, I think, you know, people are willing to pay for things that they believe the value is there, right? So it's not about value as just cheapness. It's value as in, I'm paying more because I am getting this and all this other stuff on top of it.
Yes. Yes. And I think that ties into what you're saying, that if the product is different and or if the service is different or the way in which the brand is presenting itself is different, it might almost be worth, I mean, I would wager personally, it might almost be worth a brand sticking to its guns around what it determines to be the right price for its product if it can back that up with the right product offering, the right service offering.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Your only problem is going to come if someone does the exact same product and it's better and cheaper. Because then you got a bit more of a problem, right? Because now it's, well, you know, if the service is the same and the price same, then what are you paying for again? So it's just a constant fight. Same like price. It's a price war getting cheaper. Price war, can you, or a service war, what other services can you apply on top?
Sorry, Naji, I kept on talking over you. Apologies.
Sorry.
What I was going to say is there was some quite interesting stats, weren't there, a few years ago where we looked into things like Prime subscriptions, where as consumers started to become members of these various different loyalty schemes, the amount they looked at price was significantly less. So a trend around consumers who would buy from Prime, who were driven to get fast delivery, to get a huge number of products to their door by the next day within 24 hours, and as a consequence would look much less frequently at price. So there is an example whereby if the service is so important, that then that reduces the importance of price overall.
Yeah, I think that's a great point for sure. And I also think that the more services tend to blend together is if they're all participating on the same channels. So specifically in APAC, as you know, the bulk of brands, at least consumer facing brands, tend to leverage marketplaces for their, you know, their digital revenue, their market share growth, etc. Whereas what we try and advise brands at VML is that it's important to have a balanced channel strategy, which means looking at D2C or looking at aggregators are looking at quick commerce. And I think you actually had one of the trends in the report that spoke to omnichannel, which is something we've heard about, you know, for a decade. In fact, there was a new phrase I came across called channel-less commerce, which got me thinking. I was like, where are we heading with our phrases and our definitions? But, you know, could you maybe elaborate on, is omnichannel something that brands should still be paying attention to? And is that still relevant for them as a goal in their digital strategy?
Yes, I think the answer is 100%. It's something they should be focusing on. We have some research, I think it's UK-based, which said that 94% of digital commerce leaders were implementing omnichannel strategies, but 47% of them felt that there were too many channels to effectively sell through. And therein lies the problem with omnichannel, or whatever you want to call it, is just that it's very hard to do. And it's very hard to do because there are so many channels. And there are increasingly more channels coming along. And as we've sort of mentioned about Generation Alpha and sort of learning about new media channels, they are driving a whole new set of channels. So I think from a business perspective, it can be very overwhelming to think, I need to be in every single channel. I need to be selling effectively, consistently, with the right experience across every channel. So it feels like a massive challenge. I think obviously we would always say, you know, you need to implement prioritization, you need to think about your budgets, you need to really identify where your customers are. But certainly, I mean, this is going to continue and be a bigger challenge for brands and for retailers going forward, because what we see in our research is that consumers are happy to and want to operate and search for products across a much wider range of channels. So for a number of years, we've been tracking the effects of marketplaces and their rise to prominence. We see that now almost stabilizing in terms of its importance. So I think our stat across the globe is about 35% of all online shopping is going through through marketplaces. Now, the curve was indicating that was going to be much greater than that, but it's kind of tailed off. Why? Well, things like the pandemic encouraged consumers to search a lot more across a much wider range of sources. We see businesses investing in their direct-to-consumer offering, so encouraging consumers to come to them and actually converting them. We see the rise of social commerce coming in. As we mentioned, this isn't quite connected yet, but actually many consumers still going onto platforms, being linked out to direct-to-consumer sites and then purchasing on those sites. You know, so we see lots of different channels coming in and consumers happy to operate across all of them. So not only is that challenging because there are so many channels, but what they're also demanding is a seamless experience. So I want you to know that I have been to this channel. I want my data to follow me. I want to pick up my experience where I left off in that channel, in this channel. It's a very big challenge. But it's one that businesses and retailers and brands have to take on. And they have to take it on initially through ruthless prioritization and a clear understanding of where their consumers and buyers are actually operating.
And I think, you know, one of the other trends which this reminds me of is you talked about experimentation and the need for novelty in consumer journeys, which again is another interesting, you know, juxtaposition between the challenge brands face in showing up consistently across a myriad of channels online. And the desire that consumers have to say, look, I just want to get my job done. I don't want to have to be forced into, you know, one specific avenue or the other. So what advice should brands, you know, listen to when it comes to experimentation? Should they be dabbling in any and all channels to make sure that they are catering to the audiences and the needs that they have from those channels? Or is it a bit more of a considered wait and watch strategy to see how that channel evolves? Because, you know, you could have done that with TikTok and missed the boat, essentially. And so I guess that's always the challenge that a brand might have.
I think it comes back to a considered approach still, because at the end of the day, there's so many different channels that people can actually sell through and take advantage of. And again, that's research that we've done in the past where we asked basically CX leaders and people who work in commerce whether or not there were too many channels and, you know, whether it was difficult to sell through, then, you know, half of them said yes. You know, there's, you know, we have a multi-channel strategy, but there's just too many channels to actually sell through. But much like you said, if you miss the boat, you're kind of stuck. But experimentation being key is, you know, it doesn't take a lot to learn more about something. You don't have to invest hundreds of thousands of pounds into something. Spend a bit of time just to learn about it, understand it, so that when it does become a thing, you can at least hit the ground running. So let's say you miss TikTok. Well, okay, that's fine. But if you haven't done any research into it whatsoever, now suddenly it's become a super difficult thing for you to catch up on. Yeah. Or, you know, AI, for example, specifically in not large language models, but maybe in other areas. Let's say my favorite example is, you know, Amazon Go, the store where you go in and you buy things and you just walk out again.
Yes.
Like, if you were thinking about starting that when Amazon released it, you're already 10 years late because they've spent 10 years building that software and that experience and that hardware. So if you're a grocer and you're thinking, oh, you know, let's get into that. you're super late, man. So I think it's important to test things and try things, but also be extremely considered because you haven't got, not every brand has an infinite amount of money. But I think it's important to at least put some of your eggs into somewhere, test them out, try them, figure out what's worth, you know, investing more money in and more money in. so that you can at least hit the ground running, or, you know, hopefully get lucky. But you got to be willing to experiment. You got to be willing to spend a bit of money, a bit of time to try out some of these things, or else, you know, you're going to be that grosser now thinking about integrating that software and realizing, A, you're not Amazon, and B, you're way late.
Yeah.
100%. And now you're going to have to license it.
But actually, Naji, this is how we originally came to work together, wasn't it? Because we, at my old company, we used to operate a very small innovation budget whereby we could test some of these things. So at the outset of voice, when we didn't really know what it was going to do, we had a little test. At the outset of, what was it, Google Glass, we had a little bit of a test into Google Glass. At the outset of VR headsets, we had a little bit of test into VR headsets. And it was amazing to get the learnings. And what that then enabled us to do is to say, this is a brilliant opportunity, or this is not a brilliant opportunity because of X, Y, or Z. We were informed in our decision making. And I think often one of the frightening things about new channels or new technologies is it's so big, it's so hard to understand, it's so hard to initiate. But actually what you can do is you can test things relatively quickly and at relatively low cost. And Naji does this frequently for many clients. It's just to test the water and say, ah, yes, here's the proof case, which says, yes, we should do it, or no, we shouldn't. And I think more businesses should think in that way rather than instantly going into kind of enterprise level investments into new technologies, which take a long time, which are high risk, which may or may not work. Actually test it first and then really see if it works.
Great examples. DFS, it's one of our clients.
Yeah.
I think we did quite a few different POCs to test out a few different technologies. And one that stood out was WebAR. So we did a few little tests, like I said, as part of, I know we started with, I think, 20 different technologies. We narrowed it down to about 5, created a couple of POCs, tested them, realized, oh, this is actually super useful. Really easy to implement. We should probably roll that out. And that became the feature that launched basically the day that it was available from iOS, because we had done I think it was like a year before it came out in the new iOS, I can't remember what number it was, a load of testing. And so they just hit the ground running as soon as it was available to launch. And now it's on most of their sofas. So it doesn't take a ton of money or a ton of time. It's just people hear innovation and they kind of crap their pants and think, I'm about to spend £1 million a year on, you know, things that won't work. And actually, you know, it's not that hard to play around and test things and create super basic POCs that you test, you know. Voice doesn't have to mean writing an actual voice app. We did it a year or two ago where actually it was me in another room using text-to-speak connected to a Bluetooth speaker.
That's
so
amazing.
That when someone asked a question, I wrote out the response and played a different file. And they thought they were talking to an assistant. I won't say the client, but we were testing, you know, whether or not this is something their staff would be interested in and whether or not consumers would be interested in it. And that's all you need to do. Came out of it and went, oh, do you know what? Seems to be useful, but it doesn't seem to hit the right mark or, you know, get us the thing that they want. And then okay, we've tested it. It's not something we want to do just yet. We'll wait and see when the technology gets a bit better, whether or not it's something we want to do.
Super easy. Smoke and mirrors. Into human beings, can't it, Naji? Because when we were working together in the automotive trade and VR was first coming out and headsets first coming out, we tested this. And it was a really interesting set of data that came back, which was that particularly men did not like wearing headsets and not knowing what was happening in their surroundings. So what we found is that if you put someone in a headset in an environment where they think people might laugh at them or embarrass them, that actually they weren't concentrating what was going on in the headset. They were too stressed. So it can sometimes just pop up some interesting insights into technologies and what some of the challenges might be and what some of the things that might need to be overcome, as well as potentially being a proof point for some kind of investment.
And I'd wager that if the power of experimentation, even if it doesn't require a large investment, is it does tie in back to what we talked about earlier, which is creative commerce, right? I mean, creative commerce requires some element of bravery, some element of adventurous spirit that says, here's something new, let's dip our toes in it. And if it pays off, it'll pay off in a big way as far as awareness or interest or brand equity is concerned, right?
Exactly. And with the technology of today, you know, you A/B test it with only 3% of consumers or 1%. You know, you don't have to do a huge, all right, let's do a 50-50 split A/B test on our main website. You know what I mean? Like, just test it with a few people, see what happens, or even just get a few consumers. If people really love your brand, you know, you find a few super fans. The amount of people that love certain brands and are willing to help inform the future experience, I mean, it'd feel super special, right? If the brand came to you and said, hey, we'd love to know your opinion. We want to test out a new thing that's not been released yet. We haven't shown it to anyone. Would you like to come and have a look? Would you like to test it out?
Yeah.
I bet you'd get people in, well, in minutes who are willing to drive to an office to test that out, you know?
And, you know, we actually had, because gamification is sort of one of the areas of experimentation that brands can dabble in. And it's actually quite a big area of focus we're seeing in APAC, where sort of that engagement element, similar to social commerce, it's picking up steam for us. And one of our markets in Australia, I did come across this case study for Pizza Hut, where they talked about Hut Games, which is effectively players in the Call of Duty Warzone game. Could go in and in a specific part of the game, they could order free pizzas. Now that is super niche, super cool. And it looks like they just sort of dipped their toes in the water with it and it paid off in a big way from a buzz and PR perspective, which I found to be a really interesting example of creative commerce as well.
Yeah, especially with these new channels. It's just an interesting way to test something like that because we know, for example, at some point, gaming will become way better for ordering physical items. It's just obviously a bit gatekept because, you know, if you're in Fortnite, something you've got to do it in V-Bucks. But it's going to come. You know, it's gonna happen at some point. And so Pizza Hut now have a really good idea of, you know, what that means and the player base and the kind of people that play that game and how to connect with them and all that kind of stuff.
And I think this links back to some other trends that we talked about, which is kind of what is a consumer? What is a product? We talk a lot about kind of the digitization of consumers and the digitization of products. You know, my son, again, using him as an example, he doesn't deal in cash. He deals in electronic money, V-Bucks or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And that's the way he's going to purchase. And I think the stat this year, correct me if I'm wrong, Naji, is 38% of everything bought online is a digital product or service. So that's already happening. And I think what we think about this, and we use gaming a lot as the example, is that businesses need to rethink what they're selling. Can they digitize it? Are they actually selling to a physical human being, or are they selling to their avatar? Mm. I'll let you tell the stat, Naji, about your favorite stat of the moment, which is the importance of avatars and the importance of looking good. But this will become more and more important in the future.
Yeah, I mean. Do you want me to say the stat?
Do it.
My favorite stat.
Go for it.
41% of gamers consider their avatar to be part of their identity. That is like my favorite stat of the past couple of years. Yeah. Because it just shows how much of a connection people have to their gaming avatars before we've gotten to massive air quotes, the metaverse. So they're already having this closeness to, you know, the Call of Duty character, the League of Legends character,
And was that influenced by the metaverse in any way? Because the metaverse was all the rage at one point. And then...
That was specifically a report we did about gaming. So it was just, you're a gamer, you know, how do you feel about your avatar? People are just super close to it. People also, I think it's half of people, 49%, say looking good in game is just as important as looking good in real life. And as a gamer, totally get it.
And this is not just a young person's thing, right, Naji? So we found across all the age groups that was the same. And actually, when you kind of think about it, when you initially see those stats, you think, oh, that's a bit crazy. I'm not entirely believing of that stat. But actually, when you then watch people gaming, interacting, socializing, actually, their avatars are a really important part of what they do. And they are prepared to invest in it.
For sure.
And I think
about it all the time. I'm playing with my friends. I need to look different to all my other friends. It just makes sense. And then you think about, I want to be more in, you know, I want to show a bit more of my uniqueness or my personality. And so you try to, you know, create your avatars that, you know, represent you in a little bit way. So yeah.
It's going to make consumer persona development quite interesting in the future.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be hilarious. Imagine you can have potentially two personas, right?
Pretty much.
Your real life one, and then, you know, your gaming/metaverse persona.
And actually, we talk about this in the report, kind of digital life records and the, you know, the effect of the amount of data that we collect on people. You know, we always talk in pretty much every single presentation we do about something we call post-death consumerism, which started in one of these preparation meetings where we were discussing about trends. And we said, well, hang on, you know, if there's AI, if there's data, if we know what you've purchased over your lifetime, do you even need to be alive to make a purchase? You know, couldn't AI use the data from your entire shopping life, understand what your motivations were, and then make purchase decisions on your behalf? And the answer to that is 100% yes, it could. And we sort of said, well, why would you do that? Well, I don't know. Maybe when I'm gone, it might be my grandkids' graduation days or something like that. Now, again, while this sounds pretty wild, I think what it does just show is that who we are marketing to, who we are selling to, is going to change. What we are selling to them will change. So it may not be someone who is made up of flesh and bone and blood sitting there making a decision. It may be an algorithm. It may be an AI. It may not actually be a person at the end of it. And this will impact how and what we sell.
And I think we probably have time for one more trend here, but what's really interesting, that was one of the more far out trends that I came across, the digital life records one, which was super interesting. But what it all links into, I feel, is leveraging a huge amount of data. And Naji, you talked about AI earlier, which is a very hot topic. In fact, you know, Sam Altman had said that AI will replace 95% of creative marketing work, which for anyone on our side of the pond, you know, we take that very seriously and with a pinch of salt at the same time.
Yeah.
And we know the report has covered a few different trends around AI. So smart assistants, Hugh, you were talking about digital life records, which lends itself to digital twins. And I know that our own company internally, Satalia, does a lot of work with digital twins or curative AI, which I also found very interesting. Could you maybe talk about like your thoughts on AI that's resonating in the report as well?
Sure. Do you mean like just generally?
Generally. And if you could dive back to any of the trends, like I found curative AI quite interesting. If you're able to maybe dive into curative AI, I'd love to hear more about that.
I mean, I think this is one of those things where I think AI's had this huge just push recently because of ChatGPT. And what we're seeing is a lot of people, when they say AI, they mean ChatGPT.
Yeah.
And actually you talk to Satalia and AI has been around for a long time and they've been working on it for a long time. And so suddenly there's this explosion of interest for this technology. And actually, you know, it's already being utilized pretty much everywhere. You know, every part of the customer experience, you are able to implement some form of AI to help with that. For example, they've done like Tesco's routing software for their delivery to help them save so many miles. Because it makes sense to use AI for those kinds of problems. And again, when we're talking about curative, you know, better algorithms for, you know, figuring out what you want. I mean, Hugh just talked about post-death consumerism. The only way that works is if you have a huge amount of data to build up a picture of what someone would buy and allow for that to work. So I think we're going to be at a bit of a stage now where I think more people are hopefully going to think about AI, but I'm kind of worried that more people are just thinking AI equals large language models instead of thinking about like loads of people. So one of my earlier jobs, I worked in mobile and I remember a time when clients would just come in saying, I want an app. And it's like, why? Well, because so-and-so has an app. But why do you want one? What problem are you solving? What's the reason? And I feel like we're at that stage now with LLMs where everyone's going, you know, how can I implement it? It's like, well, why do you want to implement it? Okay. Have you got a reason for that? Have you implemented in all these other places that you kind of need to do first because it's solving a very particular problem? So for me, I'm hoping that people are going to come at this with a little bit more of a problem solving aspect to it. I'm doing a lot of presentations at the minute, you know, educating people on large language models and some of the pitfalls, but for sure it's going to be getting better. I can't wait. I think it's super exciting. I'm dyslexic, so for me, utilizing large language, I do it all the time. I wrote a report like the beginning of this year, or the end of last year, sorry, about gaming, and I can't write long form, so I wrote out what I wanted in bullet points and got the large language to help and help me write long form. That's really good. If awesome. You are a writer already, you will be able to write better than me with a large language model. And if a really good writer is using a large language model, they can write even better. Mm. Right. So my example is always, I've been talking for ages. By the way, I can talk about this for like 3 hours. So you're going to have to stop me at some point. But my example is Excel, right? So if you're lucky enough to be using Copilot, if you don't know how to use Excel, Copilot is going to make you way better at using Excel.
Yeah.
If you already know how to use Excel, you're just going to go into the stratosphere because you're going to know what things you can achieve with that program compared to someone who has no other doing. Okay, great. A person who never knew how to make pivot tables is now going to make pivot tables. But your knowledge of how to, say, use XLOOKUP and things like that, more advanced formulas, means that you're going to be able to even go faster and become even better. So I think
let's just get this point in though. Nadji likes to watch the World Cup of Excel.
The World Champion, the Excel World Championships.
Okay. Sorry. I didn't get
financial
it.
Financial
right.
modeling. Yeah. It's amazing. So, okay.
Let's not go too far into the weeds of Excel because Nadji could do an entire podcast on Excel.
Do you know what? I'm gonna go and Google that right after this just to find out what that's
it's
about.
Amazing. It was in Las Vegas at the end of the year, I think. So live, they had people there. It's hilarious.
You know, go ahead, please.
No, I mean, I was just going to say, I think you cut me off at the right time because I could have just kept going.
No, it's super interesting. Actually, all I wanted to say was we had mentioned Satalia, and I just wanted to take a minute to explain for the listeners that Satalia is one of our companies focusing on AI for the past 10 years. Like you said, we've been doing this for some time now. And it's a combination of predictive analysis and data science. And the marrying of those two has yielded some really fascinating applications of AI over the years. So if you're listening and if you're interested to learn more about Satalia and its AI offering, we'll drop a link in the description and you can reach out to us about it as well. But Hugh, sorry.
By the way, that's like proper AI as well.
Absolutely.
I've never met so many PhDs in my life.
I think they have some 30 PhDs, no?
Oh, it's incredible. Every time I'm chatting with them, I just... in awe of the brain sizes.
Thanks, Nadji. Hugh, any thoughts?
No, I mean, really, I defer all my thoughts for AI onto Nadji, who lives it and breathes it, and then onto our friends at Satalia. So I think for me, when it comes to AI, just to sort of bring it back to businesses, is I think what businesses really need the clarity of is, how do I actually use it? How do I improve my business? Yeah. As Nadji said, lots of sort of very small scale usages of AI being talked about at the moment. But I think what businesses need to think about is, how will it affect all different areas of my business? Financing, recruitment, legal, all of these elements will be impacted by AI in the end. I think at the moment, sometimes it can seem a little bit gimmicky, but absolutely, like you said, have a chat with either Nadji or Satalia. You can very quickly get to how it's going to change your business and what you need to be doing strategically to make sure you're embracing it properly.
Yeah, and I know that in APAC, a lot of brands are looking at AI as the answer to efficiency gains, but in the form of financial gains. Whereas I think the first step that you're both highlighting correctly is that there needs to be those valid use cases that are uncovered for AI that can unlock productivity gains for the overall organization. So absolutely, if you are keen and if you are listening, we'd be happy to dive into that with you. But that's all we have for this episode. So Hugh, Nadji, just want to say a big thank you for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure. And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to the Commerce Confidential podcast brought to you by VML. And we'll see you again on the next episode.